they ended up having a little bit of, not an argument necessarily, things got a bit hot in the car. And so it shows you our perspectives of different cultures, and at the end how they came kind of together. There's this very surprise ending, and how at the end of the day we all long for the same thing, you know.
That is true. Welcome to a new episode of Most Memorable Journeys. My guest today is in India, and she has a Cypriot name, and she has taught English in 11 different countries. And I met her at the Cyprus Diaspora Forum once more. I met somebody there. Thank you, Paul. You got us all together. And I'm looking forward to talking to Nitza Anastasiadis. Welcome to Most Memorable Journeys, Nitza.
Thank you, Elizabeth, for having me.
So you are in India, aren't you?
Well, I was actually, but I'm currently speaking to you from Cyprus. I've returned for a short while, so I'm in Cyprus right now as we're speaking.
Oh, how exciting! Okay, well, welcome to our island. You have lived in so many different places. I don't even know where to start with you, but you were born in the UK, is that correct?
Yes, that's right. I was born to Greek Cypriot immigrant parents in the UK. I was born and raised there. And I spent my teenage life there. I got married, had two children. And then we left England in 92 when I was pregnant with my son, to come to Cyprus. Just for a better life, really, to connect my children with their roots again and to help them learn the language so that they could become bilingual and, you know, connect with their roots. Mm-hmm. And then soon after that, we spent a couple of years in Cyprus. We were teaching in an international school there. And we met somebody, actually. It's very interesting on your journeys where, you know, very often people you meet influence your decisions. It's crazy. We were in a swimming pool and he was a member of staff at the school, and he said that he was going, he had taught in Bahrain, and he was describing how wonderful it was and that there was a Greek Cypriot community there, and obviously the salaries are better, the opportunities, lifestyle. And we thought, do you know what, that sounds really interesting, why don't we try it? My husband applied for a job. We both did, and we got it. And we took the kids, three children, off. We went to Bahrain, spent 3 years there teaching. It was a wonderful experience. Our first introduction to Middle Eastern culture, a nice small place, Bahrain. And from there, what did we do? I'm trying to think. My husband got a principalship in Cyprus again. Well, sorry, not again, for the first time. And as like had it, we came back, which was lovely again because the children kept reconnecting with their roots. We were here for a couple more years. And then we had an opportunity in Malaysia, and off we went there again. I mean, I could just run through the list for you, Elizabeth.
I don't want you to. I want to stop here.
Okay.
let's go into, because first of all, how did you feel of course, I would imagine that you used to visit Cyprus when you were a young person. It wasn't anything new to you when you moved here.
Well, we did. My parents brought us a couple of times, actually, twice in the 1970s. It was in 1971 when I was really young, and it was before the war. I have kind of some vivid memories of the island, what it was like. We went to Kyrenia, Famagusta, etc. And it was always with family. We'd go on trips in the mountains and different places. So, yeah, my father brought us in 71 and my mom in 73. And it was your typical visit to relatives, etc. And then we came again after the war when I was in my late teens, in the 1980s, around about 83.
Okay, so, but when you came in 92 and you came to stay, how did you feel? Did you feel that that you belonged here, or did you feel a little foreign?
I felt very foreign, Elizabeth, really, really foreign. And I missed the stupidest things like, you know, English hedges, you know, my garage door and the perfect housing, because I was like bang in the middle of a typical Greek Cypriot neighborhood with, you know, nothing in common with the ladies around me. They would hose the verandas every morning, clean their houses tops to bottom, you know, and I was kind of, I don't know, it felt really, really strange. And maybe because I'd also just had a baby, and I felt really alone and homesick, and But I mean, eventually you get used to things, you get into your routine. I began, changing my focus. I thought, okay, what can I do just to not get depressed and get out of this? I began helping in the school where my kids were, in an international school. I got a job as a teacher assistant, and just immersed myself in the community. And then once you've got to make friends with like-minded international people, that's when I started to feel, okay, well, this might be okay. And we were there for 2 years.
So basically the bottom line is that, you know, when you go somewhere, the best thing to do is get a job, go out and meet people, because I think everybody feels foreign when you go to a place, even funny enough, which is actually your roots. But because you hadn't lived here before, you felt a bit alone. But the only way is to take action and to do something about it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's it. Yeah, you're absolutely right there, Elizabeth. That's exactly what we did. And I studied as well. I did a Montessori course. So, I just changed career because I was in business before that. And that led us onto this international path whereby, like I say, when we jumped over to Bahrain,
I was like, wow, we're in Bahrain. Let's talk about Bahrain.
Okay.
What are your favorite memories of Bahrain? What was, because I don't know Bahrain well, I've only been there once. Years ago, but I think it's similar to Dubai, isn't it?
It is, but on a much smaller scale. I mean, because we've also lived in Dubai, and when you think of Dubai, I don't know when you went, Elizabeth, but it's all high-rise buildings and crazy lifestyle and all these like a mini Las Vegas type of place. Well, Bahrain's not like that at all. And even when we visited 3 or 4 years ago, it's still very much the same. It's very calm. It's lovely. It's very family oriented. Yes, there are hotels and places to go, like restaurants, international different types of restaurants. But it's very much, I just remember it as a lovely family place, a small compound life with other families in similar situations, just a lot of socializing, caring for each other. Like on the compound where we lived, we all knew each other's kids. You could leave your door open. And very welcoming and friendly people. Lovely, lovely life in Bahrain, yeah.
I hear that all the time. You're not the first person who is telling me that. I actually hear that often. And I think, it's a good, one can have a very good life in Bahrain. But then you moved on and you went to Malaysia. How did you feel about that?
Oh, my goodness, Elizabeth, that was the best move of our lives, honestly. When people say to me, what was your favorite, that is on the top of the list amongst other countries. But it was wonderful. I don't know whether, it's a 24-hour city for a start, and it was on the cusp of something really exciting. There were a lot of changes happening, like shopping malls were being built here and there. And I think my girls were entering their teenage years as well. The school was in the middle of a jungle. And we were living opposite on a compound, again, with like-minded friends. And so we would work, hard at school. It was international. They're very open to different cultures there as well. We'd celebrate all the different festivals, Diwali and Chinese New Year and all sorts of things. So the children got a lovely experience. But what was nice about it, your 24-hour city, but within a half an hour's drive, you can hop onto a boat and go to the most idyllic island with white sands and barbecue, with friends, and go jet skiing and just lovely. I mean, what the tropical countries are like, just the food and the fruits and I just loved it. I remember it as a vibrant, exciting place. But again, I just think whatever move you go to, like my parents would always say, oh, no, you're not moving again, are you? Where are you going to go next? You're going to go on the moon. And I just used to say to my mom and dad, look, as long as we're together as a family, it really doesn't matter. We're having a good time and we're together, and that's the main thing. But yeah, Malaysia was amazing.
Really, yeah, and amazing. I think it's an interesting experience. You were saying as a family, and I think the good thing was, is that you had three children, so they had each other. They were moving with each other. It wasn't like there was just one child going to a different place all the time.
Yeah, and thank you for bringing that up, actually, Elizabeth, because my girls are very close in age. So wherever we are, when they were really young, they just sort of went with the flow. I mean, when I asked my son today, he says, oh, I loved it. I wasn't disturbed at all. That's all I ever knew, because he was born in Cyprus and then off we went immediately. But my girls have got England to compare to, I suppose, even though there were 6 or 7 when we left. They remember the house. And they'll say a lot of the time, oh, my friend's mum in the UK, they've grown up with friends that they've had since kindergarten, but we haven't. We kept chopping and changing. But as you say, they always had each other, so they were okay. And it never really bothered them until, I think, when they entered their teen, you know, they were starting to divide and go off, like, to college and uni and things. I think, was it when they were 14 and they started to make, like, really good friends? And we were in Zambia, I think, at the time. And perhaps maybe Malaysia. They missed a couple of friends when we left there. But they had each other, like you say, and it makes them resilient. And when I talk to them now, I mean, they're older, in their 30s, they just love it. And they can slot into any country, any culture. And they've got so many. Yeah.
That makes them global citizens, I think. And it also makes them understand really deep down that wherever you go, life is the same in a way. You know, it's everyday's life. You go to school, you meet friends, you do your homework. It's the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just think, really, you know, what an enriching experience for these kids, being together in international schools, like 84 different nationalities. I think it was in Dubai. Just all over the place. And, you know, it can only enrich their lives, right? Absolutely.
So I heard Zambia after, was that right after Malaysia that you went to Zambia?
Yes. Yes, thank you. Yeah, it was after, we spent a year there only. But again, this is like, one of the top of my list as well. What an exciting and lovely place. We were welcomed. He was a Greek, actually. They have a Greek community there also. Many Greeks from Greece there. Oh, it was tremendous. Oh, the place, in one year, it was so jam-packed and gorgeous. Just the weather, the climate, it was crisp, clear, sunny, cool, fresh. There was, you know, you get the rainy season with the flying ants. I can just... Honestly, I don't know where to start.
You can smell it and picture it as you speak.
Yeah, you know, if I had to put it into a bottle, that essence, it's just, again, family life. You would go to each other's houses from school at the weekend, because when you are abroad, you know, and you're an expat, the school life matters a lot. That's where you make your friends and you're all together as a community. Like I say, we would go together for braais, barbecues at the weekends, to each other's houses, and also on game drives. And the kids will do wholesome things. My girls were turned 15, 16 there. And where in Europe, for example, children of their age will be clubbing and doing all sorts of things, perhaps hanging on street corners. I don't know, you know, in Europe, it can be quite dangerous. There they were like camping, fishing, going for game drives, so much beautiful nature, absolutely stunning. Livingston Falls. And probably one of the most memorable things, if I could say really quickly, when we were in Zambia, we were really lucky because the grandchildren of a famous writer, he passed away, but he kept his diaries over the years. It was Shiwangandu. If you get a chance, I don't know if you've been to Zambia.
I haven't been to Zambia, and I have to tell you something. While you are talking, I was actually Googling where exactly Zambia is, because I didn't know. I thought it was further south, but it's like... Yeah. It borders Tanzania, doesn't it? And
yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Amazing.
Yeah, old Rhodesia near so near Joburg. But mm-hmm. we went to this house, an old colonial house. It was an old British gentleman that, interestingly, was in a very funny, strange story. Was in love with his aunt in Britain, and he wanted to build her a house that she was used to, but in Africa, and take it anyway. He built this old colonial property, and it's still there today. It's turned into a museum, but the grandchildren were at our school, and they invited us because my husband was the head. I was teaching them. We went and stayed there, and just incredible memories of this colonial house in the middle of the African, you know, jungle. And just we stayed with students from the school and parents, and you know, just hot springs and horse riding. And you can imagine.
It's just... Yes, I can. I think that sounds amazing. And really, I mean, Zambia is totally unknown to me. So you had a good life there.
We did. We had the most incredible life. People very, very, very sweet. There was a lot. Actually, you had to be really careful. It's not the kind of country that you can, well, back then anyway, walk safely in the streets or let your children do that. In fact, I remember... A student came to work at our school, like a gap year student, and my kids will always laugh about him because, bless him, he said, we kept saying, no, you don't go out. No, but I want to go and get this chicken. he wanted to go and get a roast chicken. And, you know, off he went on his own. And they said that, bless him, Andrew never came back with a chicken. I mean, thank God he came back safe and sound, but the chicken got stolen and, you know.
Oh, my God, really?
It was very funny. It was very, very
so funny. Tell me something. We're going to sort of kind of interrupt the journey here because you're a writer. I know you because you were on a literature panel. And I think, is your book, Our Foreign Borders, is it finished or are you writing on that still?
No, it's finished. It's published. It was published last year. It's up on Amazon. And it's basically a collection of stories. I mean, I was saying to my husband today, you know, when you write a collection of a book can be about many, many things. And how do you explain it? Kind of, you know, especially when it's short stories. But because he's read it a couple of times. And I said to him, if you had to put it in a set, what would you say my stories? What is this book about? And he put it so well. He said to me, well, it's about journeys. I've actually written it down, journeys, people traveling through borders, which is true, you know, people traveling through borders and living in foreign places and relationships, basically, you know, who you meet on the way and the extraordinary things that happen, whether you're a couple or a single person or a family. And a lot of it is based on truth, you know, strange and weird and wonderful things that happen to us. But of course, I fictionalize it with characters and, you know, because I think that way you can make it more exciting. But the places are real and some of the incidents that happen are true as well. So
Did you write about Andrew and the chicken?
No, I didn't.
So it basically goes, it is your story, the story of all the countries that you worked in.
Yes, they are. There's a story about Ukraine in there, about crazy Uber driver that took us post midnight around the city trying to find a burger for her daughter. I mean, crazy, and it didn't get us to our hotel until early hours of the morning. And then, but the brilliant thing was the discussions that we had on the way about the country. And at the time it was trying to get into Europe and, you know, just incidents like that. And another one was about, and this was really true, we were crossing the Arabic border from Bahrain into Al-Khobar, which is very close to Bahrain. And I remember that we accidentally packed a bottle of wine. We were on our way back from Cyprus and it was Ramadan and I got really scared. I said to my husband, oh my goodness. He says, oh, nobody ever checks the car. Don't worry about it. And lo and behold, they pulled us aside and checked the car, you know, and
what opened it.
Well, of course, I fictionalized. What happened in real life? I tell you what actually happened in real life. But in the story, I changed it. One of my professors when I was studying said to me, no, you've really got to push this and pretend the guard picked up the bottle and what happened, you know, and I pushed the story to that climax. But what happened is, because, you know, you have to cover up. Mm-hmm. I used to hate covering up in Saudi Arabia. Sorry. And any opportunity I could in the compound to just be free, it was great. But when you were out traveling, you had to. So we were coming back from holiday and I hadn't put my buyer and I left it until the last minute. And because it all happened so quickly and they pulled us over and they said, open the boot. My heart was thumping. And the guard came over to my side, opened the door and he saw my skin, my flesh. You know, I had shorts on and he said, okay, no problem, off you go. And we were saved and off we went. Because, I mean, had we had the buyer on, I don't know. And this is what I fictionalized. But in the story, I fictionalized the character with Lena and her husband, George. And she steps out with her buyer on and they open the boot and out comes the bottle and what happens. And maybe I'll leave it for you.
Leave it there. It's written in Our Foreign Borders. That's and Our Foreign Borders is available on Amazon. But the other thing now, you've mentioned places while since we moved on. Ukraine. Yeah. You live in Ukraine.
We didn't live there. Some of the stories are written on the travels where we've been to Ukraine. We went to on holiday. We were passing through, going to other countries. Because, you know, being an international teacher, you get long holidays in the summer. And I'm fascinated by Eastern Europe, Elizabeth. I really love the countries in Eastern Europe. We've lived in Kosovo before. During lockdown, we were there. But it was my passion to go to Ukraine. I wanted to go, and I definitely was not disappointed. Incredible country. I just love the Eastern European. Perhaps it's because it's close to the Greek Orthodox. We're quite close, aren't we, geographically as well? To
yeah,
Greece,
and I think the mentality is a bit similar.
Possibly, yeah. Yeah, you're right. But yeah, that was a holiday, and I just had to explore this character, the Uber driver that was driving us in the middle of the night, meandering around the city. And what I found interesting was the women in the car, because I remember my husband being really tired and he was silent, and a lot of the time her and I were chatting. So I fictionalized the character, and I made the couple a professional couple. The lady was a lawyer, a barrister, and then you've got this Ukrainian driver. She's a single mom, which she was. She was talking about the problems that she has. She's got a daughter, and I made them very different in terms of class and background and culture. And they ended up having a little bit of not an argument necessarily. Things got a bit hot in the car, and so it shows you our perspectives of different cultures, and at the end how they came kind of together. There's a very surprise ending, and how at the end of the day we all long for the same thing, you know.
That's what I always say, we all long for the same thing. But isn't it fantastic that we can write, you know, we can turn stories into different stories, like we can turn things that happened into a story and make it the way we want it. I think that's the beauty of writing, isn't it?
Absolutely, Elizabeth. It really, really is. And you're always learning, I think. Well, one of the greatest things I find about writing, apart from the exploration, is the learning aspect. You know, I mean, I remember that on my CV, I think it was, who is it? There's an Irish writer who said, I may have said it on the Diaspora, I can't remember. But, and this is my mantra, if you are not learning whilst you're teaching, and this was for kids, you know, teach, then you are not teaching. And I find it the same with writing. It's really boring just to say, I could have said, like when we're in the Saudi border story, I could have said, you know, I went with my husband, blah, 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 and this is what happened, da, da, da. But how much more exciting to invent a character, a couple of characters. And really, I think when you fictionalize things, even though it's rooted in the truth, you get to the truth, it kind of distances you and allows you just the freedom to make up, like you say, a lot of stories and find out about these characters and these cultures. You know, what do they really mean when they say that? What are they thinking? What are their beliefs? And what are your beliefs as well? You find out about yourself when you're writing what you really believe in, and you say, oh, goodness, I never really knew that this is how I felt about this culture, or whatever it is, you know, you're exploring.
Yeah, totally true. And I think, you know, what this is now a different thing, but I think life, our life, we are the script writer of our life. And I think it is a little bit up to us what we want to write, isn't it? We want to, you know, like there are these memes saying, you know, this is not how my story is going to end, or never allow anybody else to hold a pen to hold the pen to your story. And I think that is applicable in real life.
Yeah, I think so as well. That's really powerful, actually, what you just said. Sorry to keep going back to the book, but it just reminded me that there's a story called In For Our Foreign Borders, Snapshots Us. It's snapshots of Paris. And there are two, it's based on when I went to Paris. Absolutely love it. I'm sure you've been, right, Elizabeth?
Yes, I have.
Oh, my God, the best, most beautiful city in the world. Anyway, and this couple, they're not really getting on. They go to rekindle their love, and it's very much about the architecture and the place, and they're trying to find themselves and their relationship again to rekindle it, because it's all gone a bit haywire. And then they meet a scammer on the bridge. This was based on something that really did happen to us. He scammed us of our money. But what I did, I made this character, she had a dream in the middle of the night. And she was on the bridge, near the Notre Dame Bridge, on the River Seine, under the bridge. And then her partner, Harry, he was holding a pen, and he was scribing her life for her on a piece of paper. And he was looking up at the gargoyles for inspiration. And she grabbed the pen from him and she said, "That's mine," something like, you know, "don't write the story of my life." In other words, and what I discovered was, you know, with relationships, sometimes we can just follow what our partners, I don't mean it in a nasty way, we can lose sight of ourselves and what we want. You know, we are the scribes of our own lives, right?
We are. Look, I think in a relationship like yours, for example, of course, there are also mutual agreements. I mean, you know, at the same time as your husband was changing jobs and working in different places, you had agreed to this life before it started, I would imagine. So you sort of don't think about it too much. Am I right?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because I don't know if you remember, my daughter always said to me, and I'm exploring this again, "Why all the moves, Mum?" And when I look back, I think to myself, did I initiate some of them, or was it always him? And like you say, sometimes it was. Like, for example, when we went to Bahrain, I agreed. I'm very much, we're quite spontaneous. There's no doubt about it. You know, maybe carelessly so, you know, the relatives think sometimes, "Should we go here? Let's do it. Let's go. Should we go there? Why not?" And off we go. We just go feet first. And we've always done it. And when I look back now, I'm hard to think, gosh, you know, how brave were we? And I think I will still continue doing this. But I think, yeah, you have to be adventurous and go for it. But yeah, no, sorry, going back to your question, who initiated these moves? I think, yeah, so Bahrain, I was all for it. Together, off we went. Then my husband, I didn't want to leave Bahrain, actually, because my career as a teacher was developing. But he'd got on the job, his first principalship in Cyprus. And I was really torn because, you know, that was a fantastic opportunity and a career move for him. So, you know, I compromised my career. And I went back to where I was building there. I went back to sort of kindergarten teacher in Cyprus. But you compromise. And then off we went again to, you know, to Africa, Zambia. And funny enough, I had a dream that I think we saw a movie. We saw a movie out of Africa, I think it was, with Kim.
Yeah.
And I said to my husband, "Oh my gosh, I'd love to go to Africa." Honestly, it sounds like really weird and cliche to say it like that. And then an opportunity came up and I just said, "Yes, we have to go." It's like a dream, a vision. I don't know what it was.
It's manifesting, when you actually know what you want, the opportunity appears.
Yeah, probably. I think you're right, because the same thing happened with Saudi Arabia. We were back in Cyprus again. I think my daughter had gone off to uni, the eldest one. Yes, both of them had. And we were back in Cyprus. And I said to my husband, "Do you know what it is, Elizabeth? I think sometimes I like the extreme as well. Are you the same?" I said, "I really want to go to Saudi Arabia." I think what it was, I met somebody in Cyprus who had been there, and I said, "What's it like?" And I thought, "You know what, don't tell me. I just want to go and find out for myself." And we applied and went there, and we spent 4 years.
Was it like? Tell me about Saudi Arabia. What was life like in Saudi? When was that?
Oh, that's okay. Let me see. The only way I can so my son was 14 when we went, and we stayed until he was 18. He's now 31.
So. Okay.
Right, 2000s, okay, early 2000s, early to mid 2000s, yeah. We went and it was extraordinary. I would say amazing life, because we were on a compound. So on a compound, basically, all the facilities are there. There are gyms and restaurants. Again, families, the school was on site. There was the British Embassy there as well. And we had the best parties of our lives. On there. Every Friday we would have a chiller and go to the pool, and it would be somebody's turn to host it. We would all take a dish and what have you. So the children will be playing in the pool. Now there's a story in there about that and about female friendships. It's called Memories from OD of A. There's a girl in there who, because many of the women you see didn't work there. I was one of them, but I was studying, I was doing a degree in English language and literature and writing. But anyway, I was still socializing with the ladies. And you know, you need your girlfriends there. You need your girlfriends. And just some of the stories, just, you know, one of them looking after her mother. There was another lady who had an autistic son. Just the things that you miss and what it does to your mental health actually as well, because you're on this compound and really you're like in a goldfish bowl, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is there. You can leave your doors open. We will look after each other's children, et cetera, et cetera. But then step out the compound. You're not allowed to drive. You're not allowed to drive. Well, you weren't back then anyway. We had to wear a abaya. We couldn't go anywhere without our husbands or travel without our husbands and his passport. Even in a coffee shop, if you go to the mall, there was only one coffee shop we were allowed to go at a certain time before prayer call. Otherwise, you would have to sit. There was a teacher who went and didn't know, she was new, with a colleague, a guy, and the Motawa, the religious priest, caught them, and they had to produce a wedding certificate. And I'm not quite sure, I can't remember fully what happened, but they got into trouble. So it was this dual kind of life inside and out. You've got one foot into this oasis of parties and fun and, you know, this wonderful lifestyle. And then out you go and it's completely, I mean, even the malls outside, the advertisements that were up on the mall buildings, the ladies' faces would be crossed out with black pen, and the body parts and things like that.
Amazing. Yeah. I think, though, I spoke to a friend recently. Actually, she's a flight attendant and she travels a lot. And she has been to Saudi recently. I think it was the beginning of this year. And she was actually traveling around in a car on her own.
Wow.
Things have changed.
Yes, yes. In fact, we were in Riyadh. We went back to Saudi Arabia 3 years ago before China. And we were there for a year in Riyadh. And yeah, you're absolutely right, because Riyadh is super strict as well. I mean, we had a big house there, but we were right in the middle of because I said to my husband, if we go back to Saudi this time, I would like to live amongst the locals and see what that feels like. Because before we were there, Europe, yeah. So it was a typical neighborhood, an apartment, a house, and I would wait for him. I didn't feel comfortable going out because I won't cover my hair, you see. You don't have to cover your hair now. But the abaya would go on and there were mosques and it was only men in the street crossing. I just didn't want to stick out and I didn't feel safe. But the minute my husband came home, we would go for a walk around the local little park and the neighborhoods. And that was lovely. It was lovely to see the local life. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just heard something before in a phrase. Were you in China?
Yeah, we were. We were twice in China. We went to Shanghai for a short while and absolutely adored that.
It was yes.
Isn't it nice?
Oh, yeah. And where else did you go?
Recently, Ningbo. We were both teaching there. I was teaching English and I was head of early years. It was lovely. It's only about an hour and a half from Shanghai. It's on the south of the Yangtze River. So there's a lot of lakes and beautiful greenery, and I love China.
I came back from China. I don't know if you've seen it on social media. My son is studying in China, and I absolutely loved everything.
Yeah. It's the most incredible culture, and the people. You can be anyone you want in China. Nobody bothers you. I said to my husband, "You can stick a pineapple on your head, walk down the street, and
nobody cares." But what really fascinated me also is that there are so many people, there is so much going on, and it's so well organized.
Yes, incredible, absolutely amazing. I mean, I know now I've realized it, you know, it was totally a cashless society back then. Everything is easy, you're absolutely right. It's roads, the gardeners, the beautiful landscape, whatever you want, the infrastructure is incredible. Your phone, it runs out of charge, no problem. Pop outside there, get it charged. You know, right? In the malls, where
everything, it's crazy. I mean, it really, really is, and totally cashless, as you says. Alipay is king.
Yeah, absolutely. And Taobao. Did you come across Taobao in China? Taobao. It's an app for buying anything you want.
No, I wasn't there long enough to do that. My son probably has it, but that's probably what he uses. Now, Nitsa, time is flying. We're getting to the end.
Okay.
We've got another few more minutes. One thing that I want to mention is that the first book that you wrote is called Hamsters, Rats, and Other Stuff.
that's it going on. Hamster rats and other stuff going on.
So that's one thing. That's because we want to promote you a little bit. That is also available on Amazon, and Our Foreign Borders is available on Amazon. And then there is Sea with Salty Water. Is that on Amazon yet or not?
Not yet. I'm still writing that one. Okay. Probably why the universe has brought us back here, so I can do my research.
I see. You see, the universe knows what it does, doesn't it?
Does indeed.
What do you think is next? You're here now. Do you think you're going to stay?
I really don't know, Elizabeth. I get very restless. It's awful, isn't it? I mean, my daughter is around the corner with a lovely family. I've got three grandchildren. And my son, Mike, is in Dubai. You know, the one that was working in China. He's in Dubai with his wife. They got married last year. And my daughter with her husband, they're in Dubai as well with their little child. So we're all geographically closer than we've ever been. So that's mm-hmm. quite nice. But look, if an opportunity comes again and, you know, it says go here, go there, I'll probably, my children will be listening now. Oh, dear. But they know they know by now what we're like. But for now, we're here. We're exploring. We're hiking and enjoying. And we'll see. We'll see. Options
are open. Brilliant. Well, I will be watching you. And in case you go somewhere crazy and exciting, maybe we'll just have to do another episode.
Yeah, well, I know. I would love that. Thank you.
Okay. For now, we're going to leave it here. I want to thank you so much for being on Most Memorable Journeys today, Nitza Anastasiadis.
Thank you very much indeed, Elizabeth. It was a pleasure talking to you.
If you enjoy my podcast, please like, share, and subscribe to my channel. You will find all the information in the show notes.